Well, let's... Folks, let's take our seats there, folks. Well, maybe we could resume and we'll Henry Shue has some remarks to add, and then Orrin Young has just a few words to add to that, and then I thought we'd ask Steve Cacqui to speak, and then I thought we would really simply have a general discussion for the remainder of the morning and the afternoon. That is, I thought we would ask Raina Green to open the discussion and then ask Verna and Oscar and Gard and indeed all others to participate, not simply confining ourselves to education, but talking about the whole question of what standards or criteria might have to be met in order to establish what might be called a true or viable self-determination. And in that general discussion, we might be able to wind up our thoughts, and it could be informal, and it might well be understood that no one would take more than just a few minutes, so that there could be a little more give and take than there has been, and I take full responsibility for the way in which we've proceeded thus far, but it has given rise to a certain groundswell of opinion that we should alter the mode of procedure later on today, and we will. So, Henry, carry on, please.
Try to help establish the new precedent of brief interventions. First, just a footnote to emphasize one thing that I said already. I'm not suggesting that in any way that land is somehow inherently inalienable. Obviously, you can divide it up and sell it and trade it. The argument clearly has to be by way of lands being inseparable from a people's identity. It's because and only when the land is inseparable from identity that you can make the inalienability argument go, I think. I really just want to mention some topics now rather than discuss them, just to get them into the record. One is national security. All that I've been saying so far has been about how to formulate the rights and how to defend the rights. Usually, people who in practice are going to ignore human rights don't deny them, They claim that something else overrides them in this case, and in U.S. foreign policy, at least, and perhaps in domestic policy up here, national security is the most usual thing. We have continued to cooperate with various outrageous violators of human rights. What we say is not that that the rights they're violating don't exist or aren't relevant or something, but that our interest in national security is overriding in that particular case. And I simply want to emphasize what I think is quite clear anyway, is that that's not true just because it's said. I mean, that case, the case that national security is more important in this instance than the rights are in this instance, has to be shown. There is, of course, a right to security, and so there can be genuine conflicts between national security and other kinds of rights. But what has to be shown is that there is that kind of conflict in a particular case, and that satisfying the other right will cause more damage to national security than ignoring that right would cause to that right. I mean, as a minimum, you've got to show that, on the whole, you're doing more for rights. And you, I think, really have to very strongly make the case that it's not just somehow imaginable that this might affect national security. I mean, you really have to show that it will indeed, in a very serious way, affect national security if it will indeed, in a very serious way, affect other people's rights. Finally, I would like just to mention the fact that we are making international human rights law. I mean, laws are made through cases, through court decisions, and the fact that some things are not so clear should be accepted, I think, as a challenge. Alaskan peoples have plenty of problems of their own. I'm sure you're not looking for other problems to take on, but I think you should know that in fighting your own battles, you may be helping along with other indigenous people to establish in a clearer way principles that are perhaps not so clear now. But conceptions of human rights do change. In the United Nations, they talk about three generations of human rights. Not everybody is on board even with the second generation, and I for one have some doubts about the so-called third generation myself, but the point is just that we argue about these things, we adjudicate these things, and gradually we come to agreements, and sometimes we come to agreements that things we didn't think were rights before, we now do think are rights. And it's not that the oldest rights somehow get priority. If we really accept a right, then it really is a right. So I think that you can contribute to this this process and should welcome the chance. On the other hand, and this is the final thing, although rights change, they don't change just because individual governments say they do. They don't change because individual scholars say they do either. I can't just announce one and that makes it a right. But neither can governments. I mean, the whole point about human rights is that they are prior to the decisions of governments. And I mean, this is as American an idea as you can get. I mean, that was the whole point about the American Revolution, that there were rights prior to government acts, and government acts could be judged in terms of those rights. And the sort of language that you find in ANCSA is really quite wonderful, I think. I mean, it says things like, all Aboriginal titles are hereby extinguished. Well, I don't know. It depends what those titles are based on. If they're based on genuine human rights, they're not the sort of thing that governments can extinguish.
Thank you, Henry. Oren, you wanted to say a few words before we pass on to Steve.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to make a few brief observations about international law and then to draw out some of their implications for indigenous peoples and the concept of group rights. But before doing that, let me just make one quick observation or response to something that Henry has said that struck me as very interesting. It occurs to me that there's nothing whatsoever mysterious about the idea of land as an indivisible asset of a group, even in our dominant Western culture. We're all familiar with various notions of undivided shares in land. And in fact, we have quite an elaborate set of legal distinctions about different kinds of undivided shares in land. It may be that we often associate that with groups that are quite different from indigenous groups. One of the most ordinary groups holding undivided shares in land is the family, for example, a set of members of a blood-related family. What I think really is the mysterious or problematic issue with respect to land is the alienability or inalienability question rather than the indivisibility question. The whole notion that land is quintessentially alienable is incredibly deeply embedded in dominant Western ideologies, and particularly the prevailing or the most powerful economic ideology of Western capitalist society. In fact, the alienability of land and other assets is celebrated in modern neoclassical economics as being one of its principal virtues. Therein lies the possibility of achieving allocative efficiency in economic terms. If you didn't have transferability and alienability, it would lead to economic inefficiency. And by the way, that's part of the ideology that's produced things like the limited entry system. Efforts to create alienability in situations where it previously didn't exist. So that, I think, is the real sort of ideological, conceptual baggage that has to be overcome. Now, let me very quickly try to say some things about international law. And perhaps I should just preface these remarks by saying that my professional background is really in the field of general international relations and international politics rather than in law per se. But I want to speak to international law as a facet of international relations. By and large, international law at any given period in time reflects to a very large degree the political and economic realities of that time. What we call modern international law, which really emerged and was articulated and codified in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, and which places such a dominant emphasis on the state being the only true actor, the state being the fundamental building block, the central structural element of the entire system, was a doctrine. A set of ideas that became politically an exceedingly powerful tool in the hands of certain centralizing European elites. It's true, of course, that this doctrine later on played an important role in the dealings among European colonial powers. But what was going on in Europe at that time? There were lots of separatist movements within France, Spain, what we now call Great Britain. The doctrines of international law provided powerful, conceptual, theoretical tools which the elites that later on gained control in the name of the state, in the name ultimately of the nation state, were able to make use of in order to suppress and overcome the opposition of other groups. In fact, they not only succeeded in their own terms, but they succeeded beyond probably their wildest expectations. The doctrines of what we call modern international law, with the dominant central role of the state, became a conceptual theoretical system which spread in time and geographical place far beyond the concerns of those who created it. It's probably one of the greatest, most powerful developments of ideas known in human history. And so you get all of this baggage which, from the point of view of group rights or indigenous peoples, now in many ways constitute very powerful obstacles to be overcome, chipped away at, eroded, gradually transcended, all the things that we've heard Doug and Sandy and Henry and so on talk about. Nevertheless, the core still remains there as a sort of a obstacle or a problem to be overcome in the forms of domestic jurisdiction, states as true subjects, various conceptions of sovereignty. Now, it seems to me that, and this is what I really want to say in this context, it seems to me that what is really important is to look around to see whether or not there are important, large-scale, powerful changes going on in international society which are having and will have the effect of diminishing, breaking down, changing, transforming the dominant role of the state as the principal, not only juridical, but political and economic reality of the system. And from the point of view of indigenous peoples, it seems to me that the good news is that the answer to that question is yes. There are a whole series of very powerful, fundamental economic and political changes that are occurring and which are changing the international institutional, including legal, system in some profound ways, which could prove very helpful, beneficial to the concerns of indigenous aboriginal groups within the boundaries of nation states. These, by and large, are not the movements of indigenous peoples as the most sort of powerful ones. They are things like the rapid growth of ethnic separatist movements in the traditional core European states, the ethnic separatism of which is now reemerging of the original internal colonial problem of Wales, for example, the Brittany problem, the Quebec problem, the continuing Belgium problem with the Flemings and the Walloons and all those kinds of things. A very powerful set of developments which could very well lead to profound changes. They are things like the emergence in the mid and late 20th century of multinational corporations, incredibly powerful, not only economic, but political institutions and organizations which are calling into question the old sort of sub, let's call it deep structure of the pre-existing system. Transnational financial institutions, which increasingly states can't control legally or in any other way, which are becoming very sort of powerful independent players. Transnational environmental movements, which may seem a little softer to some people than financial institutions, but which nevertheless, in some very significant situations, are now being able to wield power and influence far beyond the control of nation states, are becoming realities in the system. And the juridical, legal structure is bound, it seems to me, to adjust, evolve, shift in ways that will increasingly recognize these realities. Now, why is this the good news from the point of view of indigenous peoples?
If I might, one more thing you should add is transnational terrorism.
Certainly.
Yes.
Certainly. And there were several others that if we were making a complete list, we could possibly add. It's the good news because I think it's really for the first time in probably centuries raising very profound questions about the entire conceptual structure, vocabulary, and so on. It is a good era, in a certain sense, for indigenous peoples to be raising their concerns, to be articulating increasingly their interests, their problems, not because they themselves are so powerful and because they themselves can somehow shake states to change in some radical way, but because they can attach or link their concerns to a set of other concerns going on at the same time, and I think benefit potentially in a very profound and substantial way from the fundamental transforming forces that are taking place with respect to these other developments. And my suggestion or my concrete recommendation is that in addition to looking at the human rights issues and some of these other developments in international law, indigenous peoples, if they want to achieve their goals in terms of practical, concrete, political realities, would be very well advised to open up the most extensive and the best possible working relationships with the leadership of these other profoundly transforming forces. They should be on good terms with transnational environmental groups. They should not reject out of hand multinational corporations, because while they may be exploitative and raping the land in certain respects, they represent a force moving in the same direction in certain senses. Indigenous peoples, in other words, should work very hard to make common cause, to link their concerns, to develop good working relationships with these other transforming institutional forces, many of which are exceedingly well financed and have access to a lot of the other sort of levers of power and influence and access to the media and so on. And that, I think, could be an extremely effective initiative or strategy, let's call it, over the next generation for indigenous peoples to have their views injected significantly into this whole transforming process.
Thank you. I think that what we'll do now is move on and call on Steve Kekwe to speak. And once again, I welcome Steve, who was here when we began our first round table in March of 84. And I'm glad he was able to return, if only for the last 2 days of the round table. And just before Steve begins, I've been asked to say that for some of the folks in the room, the smoking is a bit of an irritant. So if you are smoking, you're entitled to continue. But if you feel that you'd like to extinguish, if that's the right word, your smoking materials, please feel free to do so. Well, Steve Kekwe, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. What I'd like to speak about to you is about some of the work that as Aboriginal people in Northern Canada we've undertaken over the last number of years. In Northern Canada, the last part, I guess, of it, of what you might call a frontier, is also the homeland of the Dene Nation and the Inuit, the Eskimo people as well, and Métis. That is, Métis being people that are a mix, people of mixed blood that have, in some people's opinion, I guess, a separate culture from the original Aboriginal people. In any case, the Northwest Territories is about a million and a half square miles of lots of bush and snow. There's a lot of islands up there. It's largely about the size of about one third of Canada's landmass. It's a very large area, and it's populated only by about 40,000 people, the majority of which are Aboriginal. That is, the Dene, along with the Inuit, form the majority of the population up there. And what we've undertaken is to redesign the territorial government, which is basically a colonial government, and to make some changes to it so that we can fit ourselves more appropriately or fit the government into the way in which we choose to make decisions and conduct our business up there. And it has the blessing of the, or had when I left, the blessing of the Canadian government. I say that because it's, 10 years ago or so when the Dene Nation was starting to organize politically, we issued a very controversial statement, which has put us up in the front pages of the media for about a week. The statement was basically a declaration of how we see ourselves, and it was called the Dene Declaration. It stated how we see ourselves in a world community, and basically declared ourselves as members of the world community with certain rights. The two most controversial parts of the declaration was the part that read, the government of the Northwest Territories is not the government of the Dene, and the government of Canada is not the government of the Dene. And that put us out, way out in the left field with the extreme radicals of the day, and as well with the separatists of Quebec for a number of reasons, but it was a statement that isolated us for a number of years. We were in the bad books, I guess, of the government. We had incredible problems with our relationship with the government for some years. But we were very serious about those two statements that were included in the declaration. And the present situation with us speaks to that fact. The statement about how we view the government of Canada, what we were saying there is that the federal government had not yet worked out with us, not only as Dene people, but as Aboriginal people in Canada, a place in that country, and that in the Constitution of Canada, it was not sufficient work done to guarantee us constitutional protection. And further to that, legislation that would specify exactly how the relationship that we would have with the federal government would be implemented would be manifested, I guess, at the community or regional level. The second part of the statement, which we talked about the government of the Northwest Territories not being the government of the Dene. It's a colonial government, and was more so 10 years ago, where people were just elected to this territorial council, which is, for all practical purposes, a colonial government. That is, the federal government in Canada still owned all the resources, basically made all the major decisions about what happened in the Northwest Territories. And the Legislative Assembly, or the Territorial Council, I guess, as it is still legally, had subcontracts with the federal government to run education, some medical services, social services, but all the major and the political power still was with, in fact, one of the cabinet ministers in the federal government, what they call the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs. For up until 1976, I believe, or 78, the Dene Nation boycotted this government and its elected council, because we did not recognize that the government of Canada had a right to give us this creature that had no power, as if to say we had no right to make major decisions about our land and our people and how we live, and that we insisted on initiating some process where we would have a right, along with not just the Inuit, but with the non-native people as well of the Northwest Territories, to redesign a government that we could identify with, that we could, as you might say, find a way to design our place in the Western world, or in Canada for that part. And this is what we initiated about 3 years ago. The elected people on the Territorial Council agreed and did make some statements suggesting that they saw the government as an interim government, in that a process of constitutional development would be undertaken, and it was. There was an agreement with the Inuit in the Eastern Arctic, who complained for years that the government was too far from them, and that what they wanted was to divide the Northwest Territories into two territories, and that the eastern part, which would be largely dominated by the Inuit, would be called Nunavut, which means our land, I believe. I mean, I don't speak the language, but I think that's what it means. The interesting thing about it is that, like I say, the entire Northwest Territories is 1.5 million square miles, and it's populated only by a little over 40,000 people, I believe. And yet, people agreed, yes, we will divide the territories, yes, we will undertake discussions to develop constitutions for the two territories which we agreed we would create. And the government of Canada as well accepted that whole notion. And you know, politically they supported it, financially the support was there. Of course, we ran into difficulties. The difficulty was that I think there was two difficulties. One, the Inuit of the Eastern Arctic wanted an early agreement on division. That is, the priority would be to focus attention on where the boundary was going to be that would divide us into two territories. The Dene Nation supported a vote on that process, even though we had very strong reservations about whether or not we could agree to division before we talked about constitutional development. And that's where we ran into some problems, because the Inuit and the cousins, or the Inuvialuit, whom are originally Alaskans that came down to the Beaufort Sea, wanted, along with the Inuit of the Eastern Arctic, to be in one big territory together. So the argument started to sound like the creation of an ethnic homeland. And so that impression, I guess, didn't do anybody any great favors. But ourselves in the western part of the territory, we had absolutely no interest in supporting division if the territory in which we were going to be was not of sufficient size and with sufficient resources to satisfy us. As well, we wanted the communication and transportation links to make sense. And that was the argument we had about the proposed division, which was supposed to take place along the tree line. That is, the Inuit were saying, we want all our traditional lands, and we want to take all our people with us. And we didn't quite agree with that. So we are presently at an impasse. it seems difficult for us to support what you call an Inuit homeland, because one of the things that happened to is the Beaufort Sea is, I think, about two or three different, it's hundreds and hundreds of miles between the Beaufort Sea and Baffin Island. And one of the original arguments that the Inuit were using was that Yellowknife was too far away from the Inuit of the Eastern Arctic, and that the big argument on which we supported them was that they wanted to bring government closer to themselves. But the way that the proposed division, they're right back to square one, where their territory was so big that people in Frobisher and Tuktoyaktuk and the Beaufort Sea never see each other. They never have. There is no relationship. There's no transportation. There's no communication links at all. But that is where we're at presently. I think for some people they're getting a little bit discouraged because somehow it's doesn't seem possible to some people that people could, through negotiations, decide where a boundary is going to be between themselves. It's just usually done by war or just by just grabbing. You know, whoever is the stronger of the two would decide. So some of us have some doubts about it, but we hope to continue and try to reach some sort of an agreement, even if the agreement is to say, well, it looks like we really didn't have to divide the territory, but that we should still redesign the government so there's an improvement for everyone, even if there is no ethnic homeland or a territory for the Inuit by themselves. That seems to be something that is probable. But again, it's difficult to say because we have a number of parties that are negotiating this process. The Territorial Council, or the Legislative Assembly, as they call themselves, are only one of the parties involved in the negotiations. The Dene Nation is involved. The Métis Association of the Northwest Territories is involved. The Committee for Original Peoples Entitlement in the Beaufort Sea area are party to these negotiations. The Inuit Taparisat of Canada are party to the negotiations, as well as a number of Inuit regional organizations. So I guess the beauty of it is that I don't know of any other place in North America where Aboriginal people were invited to redesign the government and find a way in which we could design a role and a position in that government. I think in the years of work that the Dene Nation has done, one thing that I always find really marks as separate from everyone else is our obsession with changing things. We're always trying to change things so that we feel more comfortable with our surroundings. An example is the internally within the Dene Nation, we started off being an organization that was just primarily for what you call treaty people. I am not a treaty person. That is, legally I'm not an Indian, but we don't differentiate that about that. So it, even though it took us a number of years, what we did was the Dene Nation now is open to all the Métis, the non-legal Aboriginal people that are of Dene descent. We have at the community level chief and councils that, again, originally were set up primarily for legal or treaty Indians. We've opened the membership to everyone again of Dene descent, whether they're Métis or non-legal Aboriginal people. We've set up regional councils that take into themselves a number of small communities that average size about 500 people for political lobby and to share information, to gain some political strength in face of other large non-native communities that for a number of years have dominated the government of the Northwest Territories. One of the difficulties that we are faced with, and I think this is probably all over the world, goes by the term of turning into neo-colonialists. That is, you know, after your people take over a government or an institution, it's only a matter of time before your own people start doing the same thing to you. And it's remarkable because it's alive and well in the Northwest Territories, with people that are very good friends of mine that I worked with for a number of years, took the opportunity, and in fact we encouraged as well our people to run for these positions. And these people that even as short as a year ago were saying, this is not our government, this is an interim government, are now what you would call ministers. And they're saying, well, you know, on the second thought, we're not doing too bad as a government. And flattering themselves. And, you know, it's a concern for us because I think people forget that, you know, they're not going to be around as ministers for all eternity, even though they may want to. But that the system that's in place there is—that's the problem, and it's a concern that I have. I think a number of us have, because it doesn't seem to take very long before it happens that people start to be taken in by the system. One of the mechanisms that or processes that we have to make changes as well is through the land claims process. And here, what we're using it for is to a specific example of how we're going to use this to change the system of government is to negotiate an agreement on the management of wildlife and renewable resources.